Right now, this week's After Dinner speaker is our laissez-faire economist from the New Zealand Initiative, Eric Crampton. Kia ora, Eric.
Good evening.
Welcome back to Nights.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, the 2018 budget is not far away now. So based on what you've heard so far, in terms of those announcements, pre-budget announcements, which governments seem to love these days, rather than saving it all for the budget itself, what do you make of the government's, this new Labour-led government's fiscal behaviour so far?
Well, they're trying to stay within the general rules that have governed the place for since I've been here anyway, around fiscal prudence. People argue around the margins about how much tax should be collected and how big the state should be, but big changes in taxes tend to be well telegraphed. I don't think there'll be any of those coming up now. They've punted all of that sensibly to a tax working group to figure out where we should be making any changes. So in this one, it'll be more signaling, I would expect, of areas where they would be wanting to have some more spending, and then they'll be holding off on any of the big tax changes. They've already signaled a lot of infrastructure spending. That's been strongly needed because that's a key to unlocking housing affordability in Auckland, getting infrastructure out so that people can get building houses again. That's very important. It's good to see that they're starting to move on that. I expect that they're going to be facing a fairly tight fiscal envelope, though. All of the arguments around a fiscal hole last year, what they really boiled down to is that to stick to what Labour was then planning, they had to maintain pretty strict spending discipline across salary increases for the public sector. But at the same time, they'll be facing pressures from teachers and nurses and across a lot of the public sector.
You expect a Labour government to improve their working conditions.
Yeah, and it'll be pretty tough for them to do that without cutting spending elsewhere or without tax increases, which they've had a bit of a tax increase in that they're going to be collecting more taxes than National otherwise would have collected because they canceled National's tax
cut. That's right.
But that still doesn't give them any particular room for any big salary increases.
And they've got the extra fuel tax as well for transport spending.
Yeah.
Don't they have a slightly larger than expected surplus to deal with this budget?
Yeah, so they've got the numbers that came out this week suggest about $900 million more in tax revenue than they otherwise would have had. But that's in the context of a budget that's around the $84 billion mark.
I might have been cynical in thinking, does this happen a fair bit? There's suddenly extra dosh being found after this government said, well, because of the previous government, we're really, really tight in what we have to do. We've got really important spending that they were kicking for touch. Middlemore Hospital was an example of that. And then just before the budget, $900 million turns up.
Well, I've got some problems with Treasury on other margins, but I don't think that they've ever fiddled those kinds of numbers in that way. We have competitive sorts of economic forecasts coming out of RBNZ and Treasury on what GDP growth is going to be looking like. Those will be informing tax estimates. And overestimating revenues now would just cause them bigger problems later on if you lock in a lot of spending increases on the basis of projections that you don't think are actually going to bear up, then you wind up in trouble.
Are there ways around that challenge, which I agree this government faces, expectations from a lot of public sector workers that their wages and conditions will be improved under this administration? Are there ways around that in terms of finding other sources of income or other ways of spending on infrastructure?
Sure. I was hoping for a little bit more boldness in some of the infrastructure announcements that did come out this month. There is more scope for private-public partnerships. If you were to look at congestion charging more broadly so that instead of having a fuel tax or you could have a smaller increased petrol excise levy in Auckland, put in a congestion charge, allow tolling, allow a private operator to put in the road in exchange for the concession that would let them pick up the tolls on it. And that starts moving more towards a user pays system rather than one that disproportionately taxes people who happen to be driving fuel-guzzling old cars.
That's privatizing a road, isn't it?
Well, it's a lot less inequitable than the current petrol excise regime, right? So for every one rich guy that you might have in a Land Cruiser that might get 8 miles to the gallon, and I don't know how to do that in liters per 100 kilometers.
Don't worry about it. You're from Canada. It's all right.
Yeah. Well, that's metric too, but I've never understood liters per 100 kilometers.
Too close to the States.
And I'm too old. But you're going to have a lot more lower-income families driving old vans around that get terrible mileage, and that's if those cars imposed a lot more burden on the road than a little hatchback, then maybe it'd be fair enough. But really, there isn't that difference there.
The current government at the moment seems averse, or at least a little bit wary, of a congestion charge system.
Well, I would have hoped they could have been bolder. They've left the door open for it. They are going to be doing some tolling on new roads that are coming in, but it's not a congestion charge yet.
Can you explain just briefly what a congestion charge
sure.
is, or how it works?
Well, technology has advanced a lot.
Yeah.
So congestion charges used to be something that economists would dream of. Implemented perfectly, you could make sure that people accounted for the cost that they imposed on everybody else on the road when they got onto the road by paying a fee for the usage of it at peak times. So then people who were able to shift their times of use would move to times of day when it was a little bit more slack, and other people who really had to go at the peak hour, well, they'd pay for the privilege of doing so. And as much as critics of it would say, well, that hurts poor people, it hurts poor people even more to load all of these fuel costs onto the cars that they drive. And you can always design rebate schemes around it to make sure that it ends up not being detrimental to poor people, if you want.
One of the best arguments I've heard against congestion charges now is that in many cases there is not an alternative available. And to charge a congestion charge on a busy road, and the only way to get from the certain B to the certain A that this road links is that road at that time, is unfair if you don't have a public transport or cycling an alternative. And until they're there, then once you've got them, then it's fairer.
I think that has it entirely backwards. So prices matter most when things are really scarce. We don't bother pricing breathing because air is in so plentiful supply, you don't have to worry about it. When roads are at peak demand and there aren't other alternatives, that's exactly when you need to have something else to ration use so that people who can shift their time of use find a reason to do so. So I don't find that to be a particularly strong argument against implementing congestion charging now.
Is there a danger, though, if you have a privately run road which levies some kind of, and has a monopoly pretty much on travel between A and B, it's just going to rake the price up and rake in the profit, isn't it? Which is probably one of the reasons why we don't have privately run roads, isn't it?
Well, you can set a PPP contract with whatever price range you want contracted in on it. That'll affect the bargaining with the provider, but there's no reason that you couldn't set some limits if you wanted to, or even specify what the algorithm would be on setting the charge, where the object of the charge isn't to maximize revenue, but the object is instead to ensure that there's a free flow of traffic and that people are accounting appropriately for the cost they impose on others. And then the revenue that does come of that can be used towards the paying off the cost of the bond that put up the road in the first place.
Now on to dope.
Yeah, entirely different. Don't do it while driving.
As promised. No, we're not encouraging that. Decriminalization in certain states in the United States, and now in some of those states, that's been happening for long enough for us maybe to make some assessment. And increasingly, we're now talking about making medicinal use of cannabis legal in this country. And maybe at some point, I think it's now, I don't know, 10 years ago, it would be unthinkable that even maybe the Green Party was arguing for decriminalisation 10 years ago. Maybe it was. But I think most other parties would not have touched that argument with a barge pole. Now I think most people are seriously thinking that at some point we'll legalise recreational use of marijuana as well. What's been happening in those U.S. states which have done this already?
Oh, well, we've got a long history now in the United States. California legalized for medicinal use in 1996, so we've got over 20 years now of data on what's been going on in the United States. And one of the beautiful things about the U.S. is that different states change their rules at different times, and that makes it easier to start figuring out what the effects of things are, because you can compare states before and after a change and look at the state next door that didn't make a change and see how things varied between the two states. And there have now been hundreds of studies that have been coming out on the effects of medical marijuana and then on full legalization, which has now started coming in. That's a lot more recent. We've only got about 6 years of legal retail sale of marijuana, maybe five depending on how you want to count things. But there's a reasonable history there, and it's just bizarre how here it's still kind of third rail-ish, but the whole time that we're sneering at America for being so illiberal on so many other margins and Donald Trump being terrible and everything's too conservative, well, they've got eight states there now where you can go and buy retail marijuana. In addition to the 27-ish states and regions that have medicinal supply.
Have we had any cases of reefer madness?
That's not really borne up. So if we look through the data on medicinal access, again, there we've got about 20 years to look back through. Most of the things that people worried about and that were the basis for prohibition in the first place, none of that bad stuff's happened with legalization of medicinal access. So you can look across a range of different studies, and there's just neat stuff that's been coming out. So we can look at consumption rates, for example, whether consumption rates go up substantially. And people were really worried about onflow into youth consumption. So
yeah,
that's
and also
worried.
You remember that argument? I don't know if you had it in Canada. We certainly had it here in New Zealand. Dope leads to harder drugs.
Yeah, that's not really there either. So in American medicinal marijuana rules, they do increase overall consumption by a little bit, but there's been no particular evidence of any increase in adolescent use or youth use because they're restricted against it. And if anything, it seems to be reducing youth access where if you're a drug dealer or somebody who's wanting to be in the marijuana market, if things are prohibited, you're going to get beaten up by the police regardless of whether you're selling to a 16-year-old or a 25-year-old. But once there's a legal market, you can sell legally to the 25-year-old who's got a prescription, and you'd still get beaten up for selling to the 16-year-old. It's a sharper difference between selling to a youth and selling to an adult. So there's been some reduction then in youth use in there. But more interestingly, on flow-on effects. This was actually some work that was done at Victoria University here in New Zealand on American data, and it came out in one of the top American economics journals a couple of years ago. So it was Luke Chu in the Journal of Law and Economics. He's showing there that cocaine and heroin possession rates dropped by up to 15% with medical marijuana laws. So people who previously...
They remained prohibited, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Cocaine,
so those are prohibited, but they're substitutes, right? So if marijuana is a substitute for heroin, and like depending on prices and which one's legal, which one's not, you might prefer one or the other. Legalizing medical marijuana reduced heroin possession rates, and there's been a 20% drop in admissions for heroin-related treatment with no particular effect on cocaine, which isn't really a substitute for marijuana.
And another area of concern that I've heard voiced by many people, most memorably in this country by Tom Scott, the cartoonist who's also been a bit of an anti-dope campaigner at times or advocate against the criminalization of marijuana, was the mental health impact. Now, is there any data on that in terms of particularly the mental health of younger people in these American states?
Well, that's a fun one, too, because there's a really difficult confound that you have in any of these kinds of studies where the kinds of kids who take on marijuana use when they're younger are different from other kids systematically. So the kid who at 14 experiments with marijuana, even if marijuana had never existed, would be doing different things at age 21 than his 14-year-old classmate who never would have experimented. Once you correct for that kind of stuff, there doesn't seem to be anywhere near as big an effect as people had worried about. So there was an interesting paper that had used a propensity score matching approach to try and find kids who looked pretty statistically similar when they were about age 13, and then estimate what their likelihood of using marijuana was, adjusting for that, seeing what effects were on various social indicators, mental health indicators. Once you adjusted for that, you approximately halved or more than halved the sort of raw difference that you'd see between people who used marijuana early and those who didn't. But then when you further controlled for smoking use, which is an odd one, right? When you controlled for smoking use, all of those other results became statistically insignificant. And it isn't that smoking was causing like people to drop out of high school and stuff. It was rather that the people who are risk-taking on lots of margins will exhibit it on lots of margins. So the more that you put into control for those kinds of risk-taking behaviors, the more you're able to isolate for any particular one.
In the 8 states where it's legal, how are people consuming their recreational cannabis?
Be a mix between smoked and ingested.
Is there any signal sent by those states in terms, because I would imagine, okay, I'm just imagining this, a theory, that eating, ingestion is less problematic than smoking in terms of a health impact.
Well, the health impacts on smoking seem to be a little bit smaller than folks had been expecting. It's certainly not as bad.
Is it a bit early?
Well, we do have a lot of years of data on it now, and there was a nice piece just a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times summarizing the health effects. Again, you wouldn't want to take up marijuana for your health, but it's not seeming to result in the kinds of lung cancer that you'd get with cigarette smoking, partially because people don't puff on marijuana anywhere near as intensely and in quantities that they do with cigarettes. There's, I think it's in Louisiana, where they haven't really legalized other than for like cannabidiol oils for cooking and baked products. But generally, it's a market in the kind of marijuana that's smoked.
What about the economic impact? I was talking to Peggy Ravel, who's our correspondent in Canada in Medicine Hat, and that particular Albertan town is looking forward to the decriminalisation of cannabis because there's going to be a processor, a producer setting up there and creating maybe several hundred jobs.
Yeah. I would worry less about job creation numbers and more about making sure that people who are currently active in an illegal industry are able to come up above board and be legit, submitting income taxes, submitting GST.
That's actually a really good point, Eric, because in New Zealand it's underground. And one of the biggest reasons that I don't consume illegal drugs is because of where that money goes. It often goes to rather unpleasant people doing rather nasty stuff. Selling the drugs might be the least of those worries, but the other things they're involved in, I don't want to support that industry.
Yeah. Actually, that could end up being an argument in favor of prohibition if you think that it would do enough to deter consumption because people would be too put off by the whole sector. Empirically, it hasn't looked like there's been that huge increase in consumption, at least not with the MML, medical marijuana rules, and we'll see yet what happens with full legalization in places like Washington State. There they've got, it's kind of a neat licensing system where you've got producers or growers who are licensed, then you've got processor licensing, which is separate, although those two could be the same company, and then a separate retail licensing. There they've got a 37% sales tax on marijuana. They're raising money out of it, and they're collecting a whole pile of data. Again, it's just beautiful, the data that shows up in the United States. So they're doing a track and trace from seed through to head that's sold, tracing the product all the way through. They still have a lot of enforcement against illegal supply because people might still turn to black markets to avoid the tax. They do still have enforcement against that, so you don't get rid of that regime entirely in the same way that if you were bootlegging alcohol, you'd get in trouble here. But you have a big reduction in policing costs, and you've got some sales tax revenue.
And in 60 seconds or less, Eric, gang operators that might have been supplying dope before are what not now selling dope legally and now having other illegal activities, maybe much nastier than selling dope, subsidized by their legal dope selling activity?
Well, we haven't really seen any effects on other crime rates, really. So there's another piece of work that is done by Vic Uni researchers looking at crime rates with medical marijuana legislation in the U.S. There wasn't really any effect there. So, again, not too much to worry about.
Eric, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Well, by the way, Eric, you've got a report from the New Zealand Initiative about what, smoking?
Oh, yes. So we're looking at
policy.
Tonight I was talking about harm reduction around prohibition and marijuana. On Friday we're releasing a report on harm reduction around tobacco and looking at alternatives there.
Eric, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative. This week's After Dinner Speaker back with more largely laissez-faire thoughts in about 3 months.